From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today is special in honor of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Monday is the day of the official King holiday. Dr. King was born January 15, 1929, and was murdered on April 4, 1968. Although the U.S. government memorializes King's life and work with the annual federal holiday, it is widely believed that the anti-war human rights leader was murdered either by or with the involvement of that same government, the one that King himself proclaimed a year to the day before his death, the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today. Press TV's Caleb Maupin has more.
On April 4, 1968, civil rights leader Martin Luther King Jr. was in Memphis, Tennessee, supporting a strike of sanitation workers. King had recently denounced the Vietnam War and called for a massive reduction of military spending. At 6:01 in the evening, King was shot while standing on a hotel balcony. At the time of his death, the Federal Bureau of Investigation had established a program called COINTELPRO, designed to monitor and suppress the emerging civil rights and peace movements. According to FBI documents now made public, the Bureau sent King a letter urging him to commit suicide in 1964 and attempted to discredit him by issuing false media reports. Civil rights leader Larry Holmes says the government's efforts to destroy King did not stop there.
It was no secret that Martin Luther King was virtually declared the number one enemy of the country by J. Edgar Hoover. It's no secret that J. Edgar Hoover vowed one way or another to destroy him and his movement.
In 1999, King's surviving relatives filed a lawsuit in a Memphis court claiming they could prove government involvement in the assassination. The jury ruled in their favor after looking over a number of documents and hearing hours of testimony.
And the circumstances of his assassination, like the assassination of John F. Kennedy, was suspicious. There was never really a satisfactory answer given to it. And we believe that the King family is absolutely correct.
While Martin Luther King was alive, the U.S. media portrayed him as a crazed extremist and radical. Now, decades after his death, a national holiday commemorates him every year, and he is remembered as a national hero. As the streets of U.S. cities once again fill with protesters decrying racism, many say they are still unsatisfied with the official account of how this iconic figure was killed at the young age of 39. Caleb Maupin, Press TV, New York.
Although Dr. King was perhaps the best-known member of what came to be known as the Civil Rights Movement, historical events are rarely, if ever, the result of the actions or work of one person or even a small group of people. Rather, history is made by the labor and aspirations of the millions of the masses and thousands of organizers and leaders working towards a particular goal. Some of these are known and remembered in recognition of their contribution. Many others are not. Dave Dennis, for example, played an important role in organizing in the Deep South during what became known as Freedom Summer, 1964. Dennis had been raised in Louisiana by sharecropper grandparents. He participated in the first Freedom Bus Ride from Montgomery, Alabama to Jackson, Mississippi in 1961 as they attempted to desegregate the interstate bus system. He worked closely with Bob Moses and Medgar Evers in Mississippi, served as co-director of the Council of Federated Organizations, or COFO, in Mississippi, conducted voter registration workshops throughout the South as the Mississippi director of the Congress of Racial Equality, or CORE, and worked with members of SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, and other civil rights activists in Mississippi under the COFO umbrella. A bout with bronchitis prevented him from riding in the car with the three civil rights workers he was training, James Chaney, Michael Schwerner, and Andrew Goodman, the night they were killed by the Ku Klux Klan on a back road in Neshoba County, Mississippi. Dennis spoke at the funeral of James Chaney.
Don't bow down anymore. Hold your heads up. We want our freedom now. I don't want to have to go to another memorial. I'm tired of funerals. Tired of it. Got to stand up.
On April 4th, 2013, exactly 46 years to the day that Dr. King delivered his famous condemnation of the war in Vietnam, and 45 years after his assassination a year later, Dave Dennis was one of a group of veteran civil rights workers gathered at Riverside Church who may be largely unsung, but are not forgotten.
First of all, I want to clear something up about me, and that is that I wasn't born into the revolution as a hero. Didn't have all these anger. I grew up in an area, when I say I was born and raised on a plantation, I mean that. And you get a plantation psychology and see what happens on a plantation, you come out of that plantation with a different mindset. So I had to be converted. An example of that is that sometimes God has this plan for you that you have no control over. What happened to me was that when I left Shreveport, Louisiana, I ended up in a high school in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, staying with my aunt. That's why I know about the bus boycotts and stuff like that. But I wasn't involved. One of my classmates in that high school was a guy by the name of Hubert Brown. My classmate in high school, we played ball together and was one of my good friends, who later became H. Rapp Brown. So it's like that. I graduated with him. I left that place and went to a place called school, Dillard University, being very lucky because I was the first one in my family, cousins, aunts, uncles, whatever you have, to graduate from high school. When I went to Dillard University, I entered that campus. There were some students who were in jail, been organized by the Congress of Racial Equality and a gentleman by the name of Jim McCain. And as I was sitting on that campus, people were talking about becoming part of what they call a movement and becoming part of courting the sit-ins, and I didn't want to have anything to do with it. What really got me into the movement, going to the first core meeting, there was a young lady by the name of Doris Castle who was on campus speaking one day. And as I walked by, I didn't want to hear anything about no movement, but as I walked by, I said, whoa, wait a minute, Dave, that's a very attractive woman. So I made a U-turn and went back, and I started beginning to talk to her because I wanted a date. And she talked me into going to the first core meeting in New Orleans, Louisiana. So that led to my participating in a sit-in. And then I'm still not converted around the movement. Nonviolence, anything of that nature like that is. I was there for all the wrong reasons. And then came the Freedom Rides Corps. My good friends sitting out here, Marvin and his wife, Evie. And so the bus got into Anniston, Alabama. I had been put in jail by accident again. And the reason why I got in jail is that Corps had a hit-and-run thing. As you go sit in, the police tell you to leave, you leave, and they'll arrest you. So finally, Doris talked me into participating, and I thought that would give me a date, and I'd go out, but this time the police did not give a warning. They just arrested everybody. So here I was in jail. But the riots in Anniston, Alabama, seeing people beaten the way they were, and we were supposed to be the host core group in New Orleans, and as Jim Peck and others were brought in, bleeding, the core group in New Orleans said, we got to continue this ride. And there was a group of people in Nashville, Tennessee, by Diane Nash and others, well, from that end was saying, we have to continue this ride. And we all met in Montgomery, Alabama. And this is when my conversion happened, and it had a lot to do with Dr. King. We had a meeting that night with a mob outside. Cars burning. National Guard coming in. And it was like insanity to me. But we sat in that room, Bernard Lafayette, Wyatt T. Walker, Jim Farmer, there was and myself, Dr. King, Jerome Smith, Doris Castle, Aaron, Julie Aaron, and one of the Thompson sisters. And listened to him to talk about love and death, and we got the idea about the difference between being afraid and fear and how you manage that, and what is more important in your life. What is there that you're willing to die for? What is it that you're willing to stand up for? It's got to be something more than just material things. And he got me. I'm going to sit down in a minute, but I'm going to take this moment. It was that particular moment that something grabbed me that told me that no matter what, I had to move forward. And I want to clear something up. There's a lot of stuff going on about Dr. King and that ride. And there was a documentary and there was stuff out about the fact is that made him look like he was afraid. That is not true. And you have to be very careful what people put and how they tell the story. What they don't talk about is the night before, when the taxi cab drivers were involved in the Montgomery bus boycott, that armed themselves and was ready to free the people in that was trapped in the church by the Klan to do whatever was necessary. It was Dr. King who faced both mobs and both groups and saved the lives, I think, of a whole lot of people who were bumming and who were also trying to kill or lynch the people who were in that church. What they don't talk about is that Dr. King who made that stand about nonviolence and love and was able to, some way, to calm the crowd at that time. So my belief and my understanding and my love for this movement, that changed me in my life and made me part of what it became a great movement and this country is, and I'm very happy to be on the stage with the people here who really made this thing happen.
Dr. King would have turned 86 this past Thursday had his life not been cut short by an assassin's bullet. We asked Dr. Anthony Montero, noted author and historian, what Dr. King would see and say about the condition of things today if he were alive. Dr. Montero, welcome back.
Thank you for having me.
Yep. We're recording on the day after the actual birthday of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., just ahead of the weekend where it's officially celebrated. And I keep thinking about his description of the United States government as the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today, and looking at today saying it's only gotten worse. You want to talk about some of the things going on and maybe what Dr. King might think of the world today in 2015?
Yeah, I think that, King made that statement about his own government being the major purveyor of violence in the world in that historic speech that he gave on April 4th, 1967 at Riverside Church. And he had raised his voice against the war in Vietnam in fact, against the American imperialist project, which back then he was prescient enough to realize that American imperialism would replace and supersede all of the European imperial powers that had ruled much of the world to about World War II when they collapsed under the weight of economic depression and World War. So the United States replaced them, and it did it in the most violent way, perhaps more violently than any of the previous colonial and imperial powers had. And of course, as we look at the world today, the American imperial and empire project are more violent than they were at the time that King made that statement in 1967. I think one thing that is perhaps qualitatively new is that the violence abroad is now being brought home as we witness with the militarization of the police and the violent attacks and murders upon black young people.
Yeah, that's actually much worse than it was during King's day, particularly in terms of the hardware and resources that are arrayed against the victims of that police violence.
Yes. And you know, it's on almost what we could call automatic pilot. It makes no difference in a lot of ways who the president is, whether she or he is a Democrat or Republican, what party is the majority in the Senate or in the House of Representatives. This policy and these practices are institutionalized, and all of the American institutions are geared to this imperial project. Unless something drastic occurs in terms of global opposition to it, it will continue and, in fact, get worse.
Now, there are stirrings around the world and also reaction to those stirrings. We've seen the local response here in the United States to the police violence with people who are calling... some folks are calling the Black Lives Matter movement, or whatever name you want to put on it, or whether to characterize it yet as a movement. There's certainly a mass response to that violence. And what people aren't so aware of here in the United States is that that started happening elsewhere, particularly in France, for example, as well. And now today, in the shadow of the attack on that magazine in Paris, across Europe, the police are conducting quote-unquote terror, anti-terrorist raids all over the place, terrorizing whole immigrant communities, basically, across the continent. I wonder if we're going to be seeing that here.
I wouldn't be surprised. They just have in place their modes of responding, both in creating a narrative. For example, you take the attack upon Charlie Hebdo, that magazine in Paris, which can be explained in many ways, the rage of the wretched, of the oppressed, of the marginalized, attacking a visible symbol of cynicism and racism against Arabs and Muslims, and of course many people who are marginalized are caught up in this idea that attacking these institutions and these symbols individually can bring them down, when in fact they often lead to the opposite. In the case of this attack in Paris, it led to the opposite of the best intentions of those young people who struck out at that magazine and that symbol. And the reason it leads to the opposite is because of what I'm suggesting, the institutionalization of the mechanisms of violence and repression. And as you saw, the elites of France and Europe, led by shaping the narrative, which made this magazine, which, you know, in some ways spews the most violent racism against immigrants and Arabs and Africans and Muslims, made it, and hence Europe, and the victims rather than the perpetrators of violence.
Right, a symbol of free speech. Yeah.
Oh, sorry.
No, yeah, they made it a symbol of free speech. They made it.
That's right. And so the perpetrators of violence are now seen or presented as the victims of violence.
That's right.
And once they get the so-called high ground and can shape the narrative, then the rest can fall into place, as we're seeing now across
right.
Europe,
right.
These so-called anti-terror attacks.
Yep. Yeah, for most people aren't aware of it. All these people that I know that hold themselves out or consider themselves to be leftists and even Marxists that talk about this magazine as if it were something of the left, when in fact, if it were here in the United States, it would have probably featured well in the movie Bamboozled as one of these symbols of racism and racist caricature.
That's right. And using the this whole thing of free speech, and even under bourgeois law,
right.
there are limits to free speech.
Right.
Free speech cannot justify violent speech against marginalized groups.
That's right.
Behind this attack upon the immigrant and Muslim communities as a result of this event, the real fascists in Europe, and there are a lot of them, and mm-hmm. they are mobilizing mm-hmm. everywhere from the Ukraine to England. The real fascists are not even mentioned,
mm-hmm.
while these small groups of really desperate young people who are striking out at those who are either apologists for fascist thinking and racist ideology, they are now being targeted and described as fascist, when the real fascists, again, are mobilizing in the tens of thousands against Europe behind the ideology and slogans of anti-immigration.
Yeah, that you mentioned the word again, ideology, by the way, which is the lacking, unfortunately, on this angry, in terms of governing this angry response or directing it. When people are completely debased and devastated, they just strike out in anger. If there was an ideological analysis done of the conditions, of course, they would see the material conditions of the police state that exists there as a, how that would respond, consider all of that, and try to win hearts and minds in one way or another, or more effectively impede the things that are being done to these different nations and communities.
And I think you hit on the key point, ideology, and when you talk about ideology, what we're really looking at is the failure, almost collapse, of the European left on these larger political issues of racism and immigration. They've kind of folded in, many of them have folded in to the mainstream of anti-immigrant and racist thinking and ideology in Europe.
And that's a replay of what happened in Germany and in Italy, but particularly in Germany, where the working class was told that it wasn't the bourgeoisie but the Jews that were the source of their problem, and others, and communists, and the anger was directed at them.
That's right. That's right. I think the propagandists and ideologues of the elite and of the state are far more sophisticated than they were in Germany in the 1930s.
Yeah.
And, of course, the confusion that has reigned since the collapse of socialism in the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe has played mightily into the hands of those who are pushing this right-wing imperial agenda.
Well, I agree with you on that, definitely. And, they have another 80 years worth of market research data, essentially.
Yes, absolutely.
And computers to crunch it. They've got all kinds
absolutely.
Of toys. Yeah.
Yes.
What's the way forward?
Well, Don, I think that in part we see it's the possibility of a way forward in what's going on here in the United States. And quite ironically, it would seem the nation with the weakest left historically and the weakest union and working class movement historically, at least among the developed capitalist countries, is the place where the resistance to racism and fascism might be the most important. However, having said that, I think that what will be needed to reverse this situation is a global movement, an international movement, which includes people from all parts of the globe. I think Latin America is already a very bright and hopeful center of resistance to imperialism and empire. I think the recent turn in the policies of Russia and China towards the West are going to be very important. I think developments in South Africa are very, very significant, as well as other parts of Africa. I think that Africa could become a major center of the global struggle against American imperialism. Mm. So for me, it is what happens in terms of united struggles, how successful we can be in making linkages between ourselves and people in other parts of the world, which means that the left in the United States, as well as in Europe, has to overcome the pitfalls of nationalism, of Eurocentrism, and what is in effect racism and white supremacy. But I think that that is the way ahead. I think we're at the beginning of this. A world democratic social justice and peace movement, which would include varied political parties and ideological positions. I think the church, the Catholic Church, will play a huge role if it will continue down the path that the current Pope is kind of laying out. I think in the United States, the churches will be very, very important, especially the black church. But what is left of the trade union movement here can still play a decisive role. And in uniting, for example, with the Black Lives Matters movement, it can spur the redevelopment and growth of the trade union movement. So that's the way I see going forward. And I think, you know, King, since this is the period of our celebration of his birth, King's legacy plays a very huge role in defining the framework of this new stage.
Indeed. Thank you, Dr. Tony Montero. Much appreciated, as always.
Thank you, Don.
And we close today's newscast with Stevie Wonder's tribute to the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.
Just how much.